Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
And I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James. And this is where I do a joke, but I'm too tired to think of one. So
I appreciate that.
That's your honesty. It's the meta joke there.
With us today, Stacey Traub, Hunter Covington. Hunter, you were on previously for Brain Donors, another comedy classic.
Sure was. Wait, hold on. The implication is that this is also a comedy classic.
No. I mean,
that's fine.
No, it's not. But Stacey, you're here for the first time to talk about a 1992 film. You will be back in the future as well, solo. But am I the only one that had seen this film previously, or had anyone seen this movie before?
You'd seen it. I could not remember if I'd seen it. And when we started watching it, I was like, I haven't seen it. And then halfway through, I was like, I think I have seen it. But then I thought maybe I've just seen the trailer. If I have seen it before, it left zero imprint on my brain,
as it shouldn't have. Yeah, I mean, like,
I know, but even you know, I saw Showgirls. Like, I mean,
Showgirls is a classic,
right? It isn't like not bad enough to be memorable,
correct?
But good enough to be memorable either.
You know, weirdly, I had so my mom took me to see this movie in the theater. It was just the two of us. Because there was often times there would be movies she'd want to see. And she'd just be like, I can't find a babysitter, so you're coming with me. The first one I remember pretty vividly being Broadcast News, a movie that I was just like, I don't know what's happening here, but I'm here. And this movie, weirdly, I remembered. I think I had like a fondness for it because it was like a movie my mom took me to see kind of when I was, you know, 12 or whatever. So I've not seen this movie since then. And it's not great, guys. It's not a great movie, but I'm glad that we're here to talk about it. Emily, when did you see this movie?
I probably saw it on video. So 93, 94, somewhere in there. Okay. It depends on when it came. All I remembered of it was the Elvises. The skydiving Elvises.
Right, and, yes. As yes. Yes. Yeah.
And Sarah Jessica Parker's hair, because for some reason I always imprinted on women with curly hair, even though I have nothing of the sort. So
she doesn't really let her hair still be curly anymore, does she?
None of them do. Actually, a lot of them age out of it, and it gets less curly as they age, so then they just straighten it. But yeah.
Stacey, at some point, I do want to hear your Sarah Jessica Parker thoughts, just in general.
Oh, this is, yeah, this is the one we were supposed to talk about, Stace, with Sarah Jessica Parker. Sarah Jessica Parker's bare, braless back.
Yes, yes.
Okay. We'll get to that.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get.
Yeah.
This movie is a kind of weird thing because I feel like there's this moment, actually, I guess a couple moments in Nicolas Cage's career where it feels like he's in the wilderness and like he doesn't really know what to do and Hollywood doesn't really know what to do with him. Uh-huh. And this movie to me feels like it's a couple years after Wild at Heart, which is in 90, which I think kind of put him in a category of like, this guy will do crazy shit. Like, he's a really good actor. And then like kind of nothing kind of came from that. And then obviously Leaving Las Vegas is a few years after this. So he's sort of in this like in between zone. He really looks kind of lost in this movie.
Yeah. I was going to say scene to scene. I mean, there are moments where you're like, oh, whoa, that was like, there's moments where you feel like, oh, they just took the best take that they had of
I
would say everyone feels a little lost in this movie. No one really believes what they're playing, but there was a moment somewhere in the middle that I turned to Hunter and I was like, Nicolas Cage has clicked in and he's Nicolas Cage. Like, I think at the beginning, he's like, I'm romantic, I'm a private eye, I don't know. But the minute that he was at his wit's end, like yelling at people, it was like, there he is. Like when he
once
had
he's
to,
manic.
Yes. Once he was crazy and just like then it was, then I'm like, oh, there he is, you know, and I got a couple laughs, you know, from that behavior. I mean,
it's really weird because like this movie, first of all, this movie feels kind of edited within an inch of its life too, where you're just like, there's swaths of stuff from the script that probably just did not make it on the screen. But like, I hit play on the movie and I had a vague recollection of the Anne Bancroft scene. And you just have Anne Bancroft for one scene. She's like five lines.
Also, no, like one of the worst openings to anything ever.
Oh my God.
There's no setup. It just starts. And like, I mean,
but very important Chiron, New York City.
Oh yes.
1987. Yeah. Why? Yeah. Why?
I mean, we all remember New York City, 1987, an iconic era for New York City.
It's also like
I'm in New York City right now, and no one can stop talking about 1987. They're just like, remember
maybe
that?
Yeah.
That hospital is so just like anonymous.
But what there's if this is about. Like, what if this is like a Mad Men situation, and you can watch the movie, but if you go read the article about New York City, 1987. Then you'll be like, that was actually a great movie because it hit all the beats of New York 1987.
It's but just like this movie obviously came out in 1992. And like, I understand if you're going to do like 82, that you want to be like, Terry, like 10 years ago, but like 5 years ago.
5 years is nothing.
It's within a penumbra of some sort where you can be like the recent past.
I mean, the only reason to have it is to create a, in theory, that he's been dating Betsy for 5 years or so, or however long they've been. So like, to create this extended period of time that he won't marry her, but like, you don't, I mean, ultimately you don't need a Chiron to do that. I mean, it's just,
movie anyway, structurally, it's very, it's a fucking mess. I mean, you would tonally. Maybe you would start with SJP saying, like, expecting a proposal that doesn't come.
Yes,
and then also,
course.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't start. I mean, look, I totally believe in Save the Cat, and your first image has to set up what the movie's about. Mm. And we're in a hospital. Like, no, that's not what the movie's about. Then we flash forward again. Like, it's such a fucking mess. And what you're saying, Phil, about there are times where they cut out of a scene, I don't even think the sentence is quite finished.
Totally.
Yeah. And then they're doing a cartoon wipe.
Well, this, okay, so the animated credits, Hunter, you also, your previous film also had, I mean, your Brain Donors had a stop motion claymation opening, which
by
a little bit more arresting.
By the California Raisins guy.
By the, well, yeah. This, so I guess my question is, and Emily, you also might, I'm obviously interested in your theories on this. It feels like there was a time when you had animated credit sequences, right? Where like, this was sort of an 80s, 90s thing. And it also feels like when you're trying to eat up screen time because the movie's too short. So you've got like these, because like these credits go on for like a good minute and a half to 2 minutes. The claymation one in Brain Donors feels like its own short film, basically, yeah. Because that movie's like 87 minutes.
A classic.
And I would argue that neither of these credit sequences tonally make any sense.
Well, that's what I was screaming at the TV last night while we were watching this, not while we were watching something else. While we were watching this. Yeah. There's nothing additive to it at all. Yeah. And I was actually saying to Stacey, like, was there a moment when contractually the studios didn't have to put the credits up front? And like, or what was like, what's the sea change? Because obviously we're not doing that anymore in these extended, but I will actually be honest. Guardians of the Galaxy 2 has that huge long opening credit sequence, which I sort of,
right.
Don't
but it's
like
at
upon
least
rewatching.
It's part of the,
it
movie.
Is part of it. It's slightly better, right? But I'm also like, yeah. It all just feels like those old, the old timey movies where there's just,
yeah,
there's, yes. 30 title cards of credits and you're like, why the fuck are we watching this?
Yeah, like the Saul Bass days, yeah. Where like you're doing these like classic, that at least feels of a piece.
I wonder if it has something to do with the way that television changed, because television changed to de-emphasize credit sequences because networks were so emphatic about keeping people watching. And they shifted a lot of the credits to the end where they could be squeezed over to the side so you could hear, here's what's next on the local news or whatever.
Yeah.
And I wonder if opening credit sequences from movies were like causing people to change the channel. And so consequently, everything
that's
changed because of that. That's just a theory.
Oh,
I have no idea.
Interesting.
I mean,
yeah.
It's true also, I mean, to piggyback on what you're saying, Emily, there's also, you know, they want to, as much screen time as possible. They want to get as many ads in.
Right.
They also don't want to pay people for theme songs. Like these are all various reasons why,
yeah.
Television got rid
and
of them
that
too.
All,
but,
that
yeah.
All changes in the late 90s, early 2000s, which is, yeah. Kind of when movie credits changed too. So yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I do feel like when you get a credit sequence now of any sort of like trying to do something, it's almost jarring. To your point, Hunter, like, yeah. When Guardians does it, you're sort of like, wow, this is a thing. Why are we doing a thing here?
Right.
But yeah.
Increasingly, it feels like a thing that is done for prestige. Like even in Guardians, mm-hmm. It's a thing that's like, we are different. We are setting ourselves apart. And like HBO does them because they're HBO.
Yeah.
So
And I think also, you know, it's I believe it's set to Mr. Blue Sky in Guardians.
Yes.
But that is kind of like, hey, this is what everybody loved about the first one was, yeah. We found these old songs that people had
needle
kind
drops,
of forgotten,
yeah.
About. And yeah.
I think also Guardians, yes, probably does it as like, is doing it ironically as a throwback, you know, like they know that some of their audience will understand.
Right.
It will harken back to when movies had those credit sequences.
I don't even like the first Guardians that much. I think it's good. I'm not like a super fan of it, but like the thing I remember from it always is that image of Chris Pratt really small and then the title comes in large, yeah. Over him, because, yeah. That has opening, yeah. Credits too, but they're more traditional,
yeah.
I guess, and like that, so I think that James Gunn is trying to sort of recapture that feeling.
Well, and I think also, I mean, in a perfect world, everything we're talking about here is a credit sequence should set the tone, if you're gonna have one, for the movie, right? Like, say what you will as to whether or not, you know, there's too many needle drops in James Gunn's movies in general. Or
never
whatever.
Enough. Never enough.
I do think that he's trying to set a tone, right? You've got Baby, yes. Groot dancing around and whatever. Like that is sort of setting the tone. This credit sequence in no way, shape, or form, yeah. Really sets the tone for the film. On top of the fact that it's, yes.
I had to watch this over two nights because I'm traveling. And I, sure. by the time we'd had this discussion, I'd forgotten there was a credit sequence. Like it's so iconoclastic. Now I'm remembering it, but like, it's so not of a piece with the rest of the movie that it just like left my brain.
Well, and to that point, I would say ultimately the first 15 minutes or so, 15, maybe 20 minutes or so, are a different fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like once they get to Vegas, at least it's like, okay, I know what this movie is, even if I'm, you know, not necessarily on board with it. Why is he a detective? Why is there any of that detective stuff I've talked?
We were talking about earlier how the start of this movie makes no sense structurally. Yeah. I hate the in medias res record scratch freeze frame. Yep, that's me. You might be wondering how this happened. Like if you opened on Nicolas Cage in a plane in an Elvis outfit getting ready to skydive and did record
that
stretch,
is yeah, right. That like, is you'd correct. Be
like, it's a hacky like solve, but it would have worked.
It would have worked.
This is what, you know what it felt like to me? It's like, as I was watching it from like a writing point of view, as we started to get towards the end, I was like, it almost feels like story-wise, he wrote it too, right, Andrew? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It feels like he locked into what it was and then he didn't go back to the beginning and do a rewrite. Like, what the fuck? Like, I don't understand how you can literally shoot a first draft. But that is what it felt like.
Well, the director actually said, it wasn't based on anything. I wanted to do a boy girl story. And it was in my perverse fashion. It turned out to be this. I mean, I think he thinks he's making a rom-com, but like, he's not really.
I
not
do.
Funny.
No, yeah. That too.
I do kind of think that Bergman is the key to unlocking all of this because, like, weirdly, I've seen a lot of his stuff.
Really?
He's like a really interesting director, and this movie kind of killed.
Hold on a second.
Sorry.
This movie kind of like killed his momentum, but like, yeah. I think everybody. So in 1990, he makes a movie called The Freshman, which is a very specific parody of The Godfather. It's a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. Has Marlon Brando in it. I think everybody involved in this is like, okay, now he's doing that for the rom-com. He's going to like dissect it. He's going to undercut it. He's going to like subvert it. Yep. And the problem is like the rom-com is a very hard genre to subvert. Like it seems like it should be easy, but like you kind of have to play by the tropes for it to ever work. And he's trying to ignore the tropes. And so is Nicolas Cage to some extent. And Sarah Jessica Parker just thinks she's in a rom-com or is playing. And because that's all the script gives her to do. So it's this very... It's a very weird fucking thing that like I love a lot of Andrew Bergman's work. And I think he's kind of the reason everyone's in this movie and the problem with it. One of the great scripts. Go ahead.
I was going to say he's written. So for just to give our listeners and our guests, maybe perhaps some context. He's got a story credit on Blazing Saddles. He wrote the original In-Laws. He wrote Fletch. He wrote and directed The Freshman. He wrote Soap Dish, wrote and directed this film, wrote and directed Striptease, the Demi Moore movie from 1996. And then he has a screenplay credit on Paws of Fury, the animated film from 2022.
I mean, of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. Obviously.
I think the reason I like him is he started out as a critic and then crossed over to writing. So, of course, you know, we're pals.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. It's the truth is that, like, conceptually, this, like, when this movie starts in sort of this, like, comedic Chinatown-esque kind of scenario where he's like a PI, and for reasons that truly are never resolved, that never comes full
circle. I'm sorry, but just you have to say when the movie starts again.
Yes. Well, when the movie initially starts, you get the impression he's a detective. His mother dies. He promises her in her deathbed that he would not get married.
When and where does all that happen, though? I needed to know that information, and I didn't.
Oh, New York, 1987 is.
Oh boy. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so that's between Les Mis and Phantom, iconic era.
You understand.
Was tradition in New York, 1987. Yeah, he made a promise to his mother to never get married, as all men.
Wait, hold on though. Les Mis comes back in the story.
It does. Oh, yes, it does.
Let's hold on to that.
after losing $65,000 to a professional gambler and con man, Tommy Corman, played by James Caan, Penniless private investigator Jack Singer, played by Nicolas Cage, agrees to let Corman borrow his beautiful fiance, borrow, doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence, for a Hawaii, played by Jessica Serra.
A lot of pronunciation lifting, too.
Borrow.
Canadian.
Borrow.
Borrow.
Whatever. For a Hawaiian getaway to pay off his debts, but when fiance Betsy, who looks like Corman's late wife, begins to fall for her charismatic captor, the commitment-phobic singer must race against the clock to track them down and win her back. Honeymoon in Vegas opened on August 28th, everyone's favorite release date, 1992, against Unforgiven, Pet Sematary 2, Single White Female, and Death Becomes Her. It would go on to make $35 million on a $25 million budget. It has 64% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 36.
Wow.
Yeah. 36 from audiences. It got a Golden Globe nomination for Best Picture, Musical, or Comedy, and Nicolas Cage got a nomination for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy. Roger Ebert gave this film 3.5 stars out of 4. It's crazy. There is a cheerfully rising tide of goofiness in Andrew Bergman's Honeymoon in Vegas that is typical of his work. This is the writer-director of The Freshman, in which the members of Gourmet Diners Club propose to eat a threatened species of lizard. And so perhaps we should not be surprised this time when the hero finds himself unexpectedly part of a team of skydiving Elvis impersonators. What is surprising is how by that point in the film, it seems more or less logical. The plot is dumb enough to be a sitcom, but Bergman isn't dumb enough to make it one. He has found a way of finding comedy in the urgency of driven characters, and here he taps Parker between two desperate men, her lover, who does not relish the idea of having his legs broken, and the gambler who is obsessed with the idea that she is his wife incarnate. I don't understand how Roger Ebert found 3.5 stars out of this movie, but Emily, do you have thoughts?
I remember this movie getting really good reviews, and I think it's the Bergman of it all. There's this phenomenon that I observed as a TV critic where when you are reviewing a new season of TV, you're actually reviewing the last season of TV, because you come in and you have two or three, maybe four episodes, and you have to like come to some conclusion. So you have faith based on the last season of TV. The classic example is Homeland season 2. We got like 3 episodes and we had to be like, this is genius. And then, you know, toward the end of that season, it's very messy. It's like, it is like that. Everybody loved The Freshman. So Honeymoon in Vegas, there's some rough patches. It must be good. I also think this movie has not aged particularly well. I think in 92, a lot of the issues with particularly its portrayal of women would have been less noticed by the predominantly cis white straight male film critic community. Sure. So I think that's part of it as well. I think people were just very high on what Andrew Bergman was doing. He was kind of the one guy doing LOL So Random, but like as like a storytelling choice. And now, now like so many people are doing that.
But it's also, I mean, so there's a lot of things that jumped out at me looking at this through a 2023 lens. And the biggest one is the James Caan, Sarah Jessica Parker component of this movie, right? Which is this idea that it was ever okay for James Caan to be kidnapping, throwing himself at this younger woman. The age difference between the two of them is pretty significant. James Caan is, they're trying to play him probably a little bit younger, but like this guy is
60.
Like it's gross.
Like, and she's 26.
It's not okay.
Here's the thing. It's very hard. This is why, like, it's very difficult to watch something bad, is because I just want to fix it. I'm a fixer. And so I'm going through, okay, we have to change the structure. James Caan is so miscast.
Yeah.
Why? Okay, imagine, and I don't know then who's the George Clooney of the time, but like, imagine, let's just use George Clooney. Let the relationship between Betsy and him be plausible. Let this person actually woo her. Let's see an actual connection. Let's see how this guy, forget him being so much the gambler, the hustler. Let's see him being, I mean, it's like, I guess it's what they did in Indecent Proposal, right? Like make the
Which
other
comes out the
person,
next year.
Yeah. Right. Make the other person a viable competitor so that you can't, there's stakes in it, but he's so creepy and kind of sleepwalking through the movie. But
well, it's like, if you picture like even a Paul Newman then, right? Like, obviously, like, look at something like The Color of Money, which comes out a couple years previous, right? And Paul Newman is obviously older, but, like, he's still charming. He's still charismatic. He's still sexy. Robert Redford, obviously, the next year is An Indecent Proposal. And again, like, it's Robert Redford. So, like, on some level, the audiences are willing to buy into the fact that Demi Moore might actually be into this guy. To
you get a hall pass for Robert Redford.
Right, right.
I would. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Hunter.
No, I'm a little like the James Caan of it all. And Stacey and I are having this conversation this morning is like, I guess I just grew up with everybody telling me he was great in The Godfather and he's an amazing actor. But I'm sort of like, when, where, like what? When did this? Ow. What? What's? But what's the performance?
He's very good. He's good in a lot of movies that didn't pop when they came out.
Like I guess I'm like, there are certain actors that are obviously sleepwalk through the back half of their career, and to me, it's like, somehow James Caan earned this right to like be in this movie and get paid a ton of money and like just do nothing with it. It's like wild.
But then, like, to an entire generation, he's the dad from Elf. Right, like I think that, like,
you
know, great Elf,
way better. Yeah, he's a role for him. Perfect role.
He's just sort of looking at his career. Thief is is the movie that should have made him, and just like
it's a great movie,
wasn't a hit.
I was gonna say, who's watched Thief though?
I would have cast Beatty. I think Warren Beatty's kind of the vibe they're looking for here. Where he can play that menacing gangster type, but also flip it on a dime. You know,
which he does literally the year before in Bugsy. I mean, you know what I mean?
I just looked it up, and James Caan was only like 50 when he made this. He looks so much older than 50.
He looks so old.
Well, the front of his hair is so fucking wispy. That top part is just it's tragic.
He's just really miscast, and there's kind of this like wistful component in the casting too, where they're just like, James Caan can do it, right?
That's what I'm saying. They're like, we'll just get James Caan, and I'm like, but who? We're literally naming two performances that he had that were amazing.
Yep. It's also crazy that he's top billed in this
movie.
it's pretty nuts. I don't know. I felt kind of bad for him because it's the type of thing where it's like they wanted an actor that could radiate a little bit of that criminal behavior, right? So that there's an element of stakes to it
he has that criminal behavior because he was in a movie about criminals
30 years
earlier. Not because he was particularly good in that movie being a criminal.
You think he was good in The Godfather?
I think he was. High tides raise all ships. I mean, look who he's acting with.
Yeah, and it's
fine.
I'll put you in The Godfather. You'd be great.
I think he's as good as his director. I think he's as good as the actors around him and as his director. And when he's got I was looking at his career, when he's got a director who really knows what they want and what they're doing. Like Elf is a movie where Jon Favreau really knows what he wants and James Caan can work to that. But like he's in just a string of forgettable stuff, I think, because he's probably trying, like he needs to make money. And it's just, when you look for a role where he's really good, it's inevitably with a really good director who has a vision of what they're going for.
It should also be said, too, that I imagine he's very happy this movie happened because I think it was instrumental in him getting the lead role in NBC's Vegas for 10 seasons. Sure.
Probably made a ton of money off that.
Definitely. Yeah.
So I mean, you know, he's got that going for him.
I think, you know, we're talking about Indecent Proposal, and it's sort of shocking watching this movie going, oh, Indecent Proposal came after this.
Yeah.
There's part of me thinks that if Indecent Proposal would have came first, that Bergman would have been able to figure out how to subvert that movie. Mm-hmm. And be able to figure out how to do it better.
Yep.
And have like some roadmap.
Or do the funny version.
That's what I'm saying. Like, have a roadmap of this is what the serious version is. Now, how do we twist it? Because now, it's like, even just the fact that he doesn't get the offer until minute 31, you're like, let's get the movie going. This is what the movie's about. Like,
can I also just say that, like, my biggest, the thing that just bumped me through this entire movie ultimately, which is that once the concept kicks in, which is, as I mentioned earlier, that James Caan creates a truly moronic situation that could have fallen apart in any number of ways, to somehow concoct this scenario where Nicolas Cage is in debt up to his eyeballs so that he can manipulate him into stealing his wife or his fiance. I was just watching it being like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I can't get on board with the, I mean, there's lots of movies where, like, you know, it's a leap and you just go along for the ride, and it's a comedy as well. So there's, you know, there's some rope in that too. But I was just like, Betsy, why would you do this? Like, I don't understand any part of this. I don't understand why James Caan or Tommy thinks that this woman's going to fall in love with him under these circumstances. I also, she's not actually your dead wife. Like, on top of everything else, it's like after Dracula, which we watched a few months ago, where it's like Mina Harker looks like Dracula's long lost love, but she's not actually a reincarnation of this person. That at least has supernatural components that at least you can go along with it. But what the fuck?
I gotta if a super rich, like, man who's like 30 years older than me said, "You look just like my dead wife. Do you want to come marry me?" I'd be like, "I'm already married, but I'll think about it."
I agree with that.
What were you gonna say, Stacey?
No. hold on, I'm thinking about that now. I think I was gonna say that no one's motives are plausible, and he didn't do enough. I don't know enough about the characters.
Yeah.
Like, they could have Nicolas Cage, forget the Anne Bancroft scene. If Nicolas Cage is kind of always getting in his own way, and the reason why he hasn't proposed is because he is like, I want to be able to own my own place, or I want, you know what I mean? He like wants to be able to take care. Like, if there was a real need from inside that character to say, I don't want to get married until I can take care of this person. Mm-hmm. And then you see all of this, you see that maybe he wants to win the game to get the money for the down payment for an apartment, whatever the fuck it is. It's like every move now becomes more grounded and real. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, Emily, to your point before, like, what a weak woman. Like, it's so upsetting. Yeah.
It's
how, you know, also let Sarah Jessica Parker have a character. Let her have a conversation. I'm rewriting this movie. Let her have a conversation with Nicolas Cage saying, look, this is going to be great. We're going to get money from this guy. Like, have her in on some alternate scheme that then goes awry, you know, dirty, rotten scoundrels type. I mean
part of that ultimately the thing that was the worst part of this movie for me is Betsy's character. First of all, I do think that Sarah Jessica Parker is an underrated comedic actor in and of itself. I think she can be very, very funny under the right circumstances. And I think that this role is so underwritten and is it flip-flops all over the place just in order to keep up with the plot. She's angry one minute, she's going along with it the next. The idea that all she wants, the only thing that this character wants, is to get married. Such an extreme degree that she'll marry James Caan, who's offering to marry her at the end of the film, just because he's willing to. Just because he's like, yeah, I'll marry you.
And we already know that all women want is to get married. So why waste any screen time establishing that?
I want to get married as many times as possible.
You should.
It's fun for me to get married.
Yeah.
It just made me sad because her character is completely hollow.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It made me very sad and it's so beyond upsetting. Can we do one tiny sidebar now about Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yes, please. So, absolutely.
I mean, I'm not going to get into the fact that I worked with her. That's a separate issue. I think we talked about Sex and the City, but when she was in bed with Nicolas Cage and she you see her bare back, I was like, oh my God, like, she's not wearing a bra, because
I was made to be so horny by this, her bare back. Finally, SJP's bare back.
As a fan
of
Sex and the City,
yes,
she is always in a bra. In every sex scene, she's in a bra. And I don't know if it's like part of her contract. It does make one wonder, what is the mystery? What is the what's going on that the bra must always be worn? But I was like, oh, this is pre that decision. So I thought that was kind of a big deal. Or
her, like, all three co-stars in Sex and City are topless all the time. Like, that's whatever. Like, they don't, her, she's the only one who's always wearing a bra.
Yeah.
So that's right. I don't know what that's about. I do want to talk for a quick second about Sarah Jessica Parker and where she is in her career at this moment, because it's interesting. So Footloose is basically, she plays Rusty in Footloose. and she's great. And then she's in Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Flight of the Navigator. I feel like LA Story is the first time that she's like sexy, where everyone's like, oh, Sarah Jessica Parker could be hot. Which is the
Wait,
year
what
before
year
this.
Is that? Oh, the year
That's
before.
91.
Right.
So this comes out 92. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I think you forgot like a big part of the Sarah Jessica Parker like origin
is
story.
Is it the TV, the Little Match Girl?
No.
Square Pegs?
Yeah. Square Pegs is like the Freaks and Geeks of its day. And like people like really totally want her to be a thing. And I think that she gets a lot of work out of that, but she kind of gets pigeonholed into this.
But she's still playing awkward. Like, she's still playing So like, it's not until LA Story, which I think she is funny in, although I've not rewatched that film because I fear that it doesn't age well.
Hunter's
face. It kind of does.
Okay.
I've watched it recently.
I do like that the Wikipedia page spells her name the way she spells her name in LA Story, which is big S, small N, small A, small N, big D, small E, big E, star.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So then she's in this in 92. Then she's in Striking Distance, if anyone remembers that movie, with Bruce Willis, where he's a boat cop, like a Coast Guard. <It's terrible. laughs> Then she's in Hocus Pocus. Everyone's favorite movie.
I don't like that movie, but I like her.
Yeah, everyone. Anyway. And then she's amazing in Ed Wood. She's really funny in Mars Attacks, but she's also in Miami Rhapsody and If Lucy Fell. She's in First Wives Club. Like, she's in stuff. Like, it's this weird kind of like up and down kind of until Sex and the City, which is like this huge thing.
And of course, the Family Stone, which just like Family Stone makes her.
I mean, I just talked on the Patreon a few weeks ago about Failure to Launch, I did a double bill with someone about that in Hitch. Failure to Launch, not a good movie. And I do feel like
appropriate title.
Absolutely. Like, it feels as though she is in this kind of rom-com bubble that people keep trying to make happen, and Sex and the City only exacerbates that. But like, I think Sex and the City is the only good romantic-ish comedy thing she's in.
I don't think she's I don't think she's necessarily a TV actor, but I think there's a quality to her that works really well on TV. That films, it doesn't work as well in film, and they should have found like another lane for her in film. Like, I don't really like The Family Stone, but she's doing a thing in it that's like interesting. And like, it, yeah, there's like a world in which she's just an ensemble player in like ensemble movies, but then those kind of went away. And so, yeah, she doesn't
have a and like place. She's got these kind of, she's in State and Main, the David Mamet movie, mm-hmm. which is a pretty good movie. And she has these kind of, I don't want to say Broadway bona fides, but theater bona fides. Like, she does do a fair amount of theater. So there is that kind of like, you know, ballast to her talent as an actor, but it doesn't feel like anyone really weaponizes it properly.
Can I return to James Cagney?
Please.
Because I got obsessed with, okay, so what happens to him? And he's in Brian's Song in 71. Yes. And then until Thief in 81, he kind of can't miss. He's in a couple duds, but it's just like a string of like straight classics
for Hunter's edification. What are those
it's either really
home runs,
it's either a lot. Now the problem is a lot of these don't hit in the same way. I need to go back to his IMDb. I'm sorry. But like Brian's, yeah. So Brian's Song is the classic It Makes Your Dad Cry movie.
It does. Yeah.
Oh my God, he was in so much shit toward the end of his career. I'm still scrolling. But yeah, he does The Godfather in 72, of course.
Sure.
He's got a movie. He's got this trio of movies that people aren't as aware of, but that are all really good. Cinderella, Liberty, The Gambler, and Freebie and the Bean. The Gambler is actually
Gambler's kind of
a hit from that movie. Yeah. Freebie and the Bean, fucking great movie that people haven't seen.
What is Freebie and the Bean?
It's Michael Cimino's debut film. It's amazing.
It is proving Hunter's point though. Freebie and the Bean is not a movie that.
I mean, these are all before I was alive, and I'm not young.
I'm sorry. It's not Michael Cimino's debut film, but it is a really wonderful police buddy comedy that it should be.
He's in Rollerball, so there's that.
He's in Rollerball. He's in Rollerball's a fun movie. Rollerball.
Yeah.
Funny like Lady's a miss.
A Bridge Too Far movie,
which is fun. A Bridge Too Far. Yeah. Comes a Horseman is good. And then he's got Thief in 81. I'm not reading everything, but like most of his movies are good. Then in 82, he takes a 5-year break because his sister dies and he gets in a car crash. And he's like, I just kind of lost my passion for acting. I thought about retiring. He was going to retire to like exclusively coach children's sports, which is a James Caan movie.
That's honestly a choice.
Oh, yeah.
And then he like runs out of money. And so in 87, he comes back and is just like, I want to work. And he still makes good stuff across however long.
Misery. He's great in Misery.
He's great in Alien Nation. It just gradually becomes like he's taken paycheck jobs and it erodes his career.
It is just sort of. Listen, he seemed like an interesting guy. He's obviously not with us anymore. His tweets were always great because he would always say end of tweet at the end of his tweets, which I was always a fan of.
That's awesome.
But like, I don't have anything against James Caan. I think that he's not well cast.
What if you did have a thing against James
Caan? Yeah, I was just like super into it. Just hated
him. Do you think in the afterlife, James Caan is ending everything he says to people with end of tweet?
I hope so. I hope he's still tweeting up there.
Stacey, you mentioned this on our chain prior to getting on mic, but it is worth noting that a 6-year-old Bruno Mars is in this film as a young Elvis impersonator.
Let's talk about where he is in his career at this point.
Would you say of everyone in this movie, I mean, James Caan's no longer with us, but does he have the most money? Does Bruno Mars have the most money?
He absolutely has more. We know he has more than Nicolas Cage. I mean, everyone has more than Nicolas Cage.
But you know what?
I mean, Sarah Jessica Parker's probably very wealthy.
Sarah Jessica Parker's loaded. Yeah. I would not be surprised. Like successful pop star
music money.
It's
huge. Yeah. You can't mess with that.
Yeah. I think Bruno Mars might be the most successful person in this cast, but who knows? So Tony Shalhoub shows up for a second in this movie as well, as a hotel manager.
It seems like he's like the whatever they call the VIP handler
guy. Yeah. We see Tony Shalhoub. Then we have, and this is, I think, Stacey, to your point earlier, an attempt to kind of give some backstory into the Tommy character. We get a black and white flashback of Sarah Jessica Parker sitting poolside reading a book as he reminisces about her skin cancer and that might have been the thing that killed her.
I kind of love that. Like, it's the one point where I was like, this movie might be doing something. It's the one, it's like, that is kind of like a thing where I was like, I'm tapping into like the Andrew Bergman sensibility.
Sure. Because
it's so heightened and so strange. But yeah, the movie never quite goes there again.
But this
and he's like making jokes about, should have told her to stay out of the sun. Also, Hunter looked away or looked at his phone or something and like missed that part. And the very quick black and white so-called flashback.
I
know what happened. We got to the next scene and you see Sarah Jessica Parker and I was like, wait, she was just like a better way to have done it, I think, would have been that it's actually Sarah Jessica Parker sitting in the sun and he sees her.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it was so confusing.
It's in the lobby.
Yeah.
He's just imagining his dead wife, and then happens to see Sarah Jessica Parker in the lobby and go, oh my God, look, it's her. This makes no sense.
Yeah.
But, go ahead.
Okay. We're going to have to unpack this later offline.
I'm fine.
You know, talk a lot about old Andy Bergman kind of being wacky and he's random and he goes there and all that stuff. I just don't understand why James Caan's character can't be like, that's my dead wife. She's back. I want to be reunited. It gives him way more character. It gives him something to play. But for him to be like, I know it's not her, but I want to be with her. And then they do this bullshitty, he wants to be with her in a relationship. Can't they just be like he wants to fuck his wife for one more time?
They take the sex off the table. Yeah. That's a bridge too far. It's listen, guys.
But why is it a bridge? It's crazy that it's a bridge too far. It's the only relatable thing. It's the only relatable,
And that's at least, say idea. What you will, at least in Decent Proposal.
Yeah.
Owns that, right?
But that's why I think if that came first, it would be oh, so we can do the sex thing.
Totally.
Because not doing the sex thing is a bizarre, I don't even understand it.
Well, everything about this premise is sweaty and annoying, not in a fun way where you're just why are you twisting yourself into pretzels to do the things that you're doing?
Yeah.
And the biggest one to me, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, but I'm going to say it again, we have this poker game. So basically, James Caan,
the longest poker game,
coerces or sort of kind of pulls Nicolas Cage into this high stakes poker game and lures him into a specific hand where he just keeps, somehow he gets it so that he claims this game is not rigged, first of all, right? Because Sarah Jessica Parker presses him on that. He's like, well, I'm a great poker player, so there was no way he was going to beat me anyway. So you're like, okay, fine.
Right.
So somehow James Caan figures out a way or understands that Nicolas Cage gets a very high hand. So he lures him to continue to bet over and over again and gets him deep into debt so that he has no choice but to give him his fiance. This is ridiculous and moronic, and it could never play out like this. It's just so fucking annoying to me that this entire movie hinges on something that is so flimsy that
you just wouldn't understand it. You're not married. We've all almost lost our spouses in a poker game. It's a situation that happens.
You're right.
It's a thing, Phil.
It was just the buy-in was, no pun intended, was just far too high for me, and I just could not from that point on. So then you have him going to Betsy and saying to Sarah Jessica Parker, I'm sorry, but you have to do this.
Yeah.
You have to go away with this lecherous old man. And basically once sex is off the table, she agrees to it. They they have dinner together, right? James Caan and her. And over the course of this dinner, of which most of it we don't see, we watch her move from the far end of this bench to slowly but surely coming closer to him for reasons that still escape me.
Storytelling, Phil. It's for storytelling. She's loosening up. She's getting into it.
But he doesn't do anything that makes her actually find him compelling or interesting.
Nope. It
doesn't matter because women are stupid. And, you know,
women are property.
They can be wooed by a lobster dinner, you know, and a trip to Hawaii.
I'm someone who is attracted to men. I'm bi, but I'm watching these movies from 92 and is heterosexuality as an institution okay? Or is it fundamentally just do we need to turn it off and turn it back on?
You need to restart this computer because it does feel like you're watching this movie and it's this is obviously a movie from many years ago, so you can't read too much into it, but still I don't know that if this movie was made today, they wouldn't, conceptually, they'd obviously give Betsy more agency. They do everything that they could to make it seem as though she wasn't, you know, completely a piece of property or whatever. But I don't think that this concept is completely off the table in 2023.
No, I mean, Hunter and I run into this all the time.
Right. Yeah. It is pretty common.
But it's just, but we gender flip it.
Because we're as a movie. You know. I don't mean in real life. I just mean sense that,
I'm saying I think it's a movie too. If she's somehow in on the scam.
Yes.
I think if you do the movie nowadays today, it's a two-hander with Nicolas Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker versus the movie started feeling like it's about Nicolas Cage and James Caan, which you're like, James Caan's like not even, it's not even a fucking character. So why are
But you said it a second ago, and I think there's some legitimacy to it, which is if you did gender swap this, right? If you did make it that it was the husband that was sold to some rich, you know, forgive the term, cougar of some sort, and that all of a sudden becomes pretty funny. Like, I actually kind of would watch that movie.
Right, but you have to, like, embrace it and embrace
Or the husband gets sold to George Clooney. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, also true. Also
like Emily said, why does it have to be heterosexual?
Yeah, absolutely.
I
mean,
I love this.
We've had conversations with our son about, you know, there is a certain I'm not going to get into it.
We can't fully go there, but there was a dollar amount that seemed extremely low to volunteer. It was like... There was a dollar amount that I was
your self-worth, you need to raise that number.
Yeah, there was a little bit of like, don't just, you're negotiating against yourself immediately. This is, there's, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that this, I think all the problems, ultimately, most of the problems we have with this movie are ultimately 92 oriented, just like a lack of time being put into the character relationships and just kind of thinking you can breeze by on concept alone. And listen, like the movie made money, it made $10 million. Like,
I also wonder, it really feels, and again, whether I saw it or not, that it almost was reverse engineered to the Elvis moment.
Yes. Yes.
Like,
yes.
I almost wonder, did he think of that moment? Like, what if a guy had to, you know, did he see a clip of these flying Elvises and go, oh my God, that would be the coolest.
How do I get there? Yeah.
How do I reverse engineer to get there? Because you can also do the story without any of the backstory of her wanting to be married, him wanting to be married. You don't almost need any of that.
It doesn't matter. And I think he's a detective. The thing that I saw immediately, and maybe I just misread it, the thing that popped in my head immediately was, oh, he's a private eye because he busts all these unfaithful men and these unfaithful women and how marriage is bad. And it it's like, I mean, it doesn't matter. But well, I think that was part of trying to bolster all of that, which is who even cares?
I'm also curious what you guys think of this, because you guys were on for The Hangover when we did our 2009 Patreon a few years ago. And I understand that, like, there's this whole genre of Vegas movies, right? Of Vegas comedies, of Vegas dramas. Like, it's clearly very, like, rich terrain. It's a very kind of, like, people kind of take risks, or, like, there's this sort of heightened thing that exists in Vegas. And I do kind of feel like if you're going to do this type of comedy in Vegas, of which there are a fair amount of them, take The Hangover, for instance, I do think that, like, everyone expects everything to be dialed up to 11, right? That, like, everything's going to be just shit's crazy in Vegas, right? But The Hangover, as we talked about in our episode, you know, problematic stuff aside, and there's some stuff that's problematic about it, it's a great script, right? Like, it's a really well-made kind of whodunit mystery, comedy mystery, right? There's been no time taken to actually navigate any sort of turns, to do anything that's particularly surprising. I mean, I guess him showing up or ending up in a plane with a bunch of flying Elvises is unexpected. But, like,
It doesn't now, come from anything. Yes, sir.
That's a thing that doesn't happen often. Losing your wife in a poker game, yes, but playing Elvis's, that's unusual. That's different.
But to your point, Stacey, like it felt like if you wanted to get there, you have to find a compelling and interesting way to get there, and he did.
But to add to what you're saying about The Hangover, what that movie did so brilliantly was, like what you're saying, the expectation is it's Vegas, the craziest shit has to happen. The Hangover so brilliantly did not show the crazy shit. Yeah. It showed the next day and them trying to figure out what happened. And we can only imagine how they got a tiger. We can only imagine.
Which is way better, ultimately, than seeing them steal a tiger or whatever. It's like.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Time. It's, I mean, I'm trying to sort of think of what I guess The Hangover is kind of the ideal in terms of the fact that it forces the audience to think of the most absurd mm-hmm. circumstances, and that in and of itself is funny. I just think that more times than not, I mean, like, take for instance, what is the oh my God, the Ashton Kutcher, What Happens in Vegas?
What Happens in Vegas, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, again, when you go to sort of these obvious kind of like crazy wacky Vegas things, it just never works to me personally.
I feel like Vegas movies need to have an element that's about money to work.
Sure.
And like The Hangover doesn't as much. I'm not a huge fan of it, but it certainly is a movie that works. But like, oh, the Ocean's movies to me are
like the pinnacle
of Vegas, because it's about, yeah, there's an element of sexiness and an element of crazy, unusual stuff, but it's very much about, there's a lot of money here and people are wasting it frivolously, and we're going to take it from this person.
Can I hearken back to an even older movie that I think uses Vegas well, Lost in America?
Sure. Sure.
Isn't that where she loses the nest egg? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. The Albert Brooks movie.
That she go, you know, they have a certain amount of money for their retirement, or, you know, they're trying to live off the grid or whatever. And she loses it all in Vegas. That's why I also think Leaving Las Vegas. I think Vegas movies should either be about like Ocean's 11, the pinnacle of cool, or it's
the saddest.
The saddest. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, we'd be remiss to not talk about Leaving Las Vegas for a second, just because Nicolas Cage is very good in that movie. I feel as though it shows obviously the exact opposite of this film to what you're talking about, Stacey, in sense of like, I mean, it's a sad fucking place. You know what I mean? Like, it's very sad. People go there for all the wrong reasons. And I do think that obviously this movie completely bypassed that. Also, half of this movie takes place in fucking Hawaii as well.
Yeah.
That is where this movie loses me, because that is not in the title. It does not say honeymoon in Vegas and then Hawaii.
It's true. Like,
there is no honeymoon either.
There's no honeymoon either.
What the fuck is even this movie?
I don't come to a movie with Vegas in the title for Hawaii ever.
Can we talk about Peter Boyle in this movie for a second?
Oh, you mean he's playing the concept of America's problematic occupation of the Hawaiian Islands?
Correct. Yes. That is absolutely accurate. I can't believe he's in this movie. I don't know what he's doing in this movie. I don't know why that scene's there. It feels like it must just be like a Mel Brooksy because of Blazing Saddles or something like that.
He's wearing a Les Mis shirt. And wait, to go back to who has the most money, I think if he were alive, it would be him.
Oh, that's interesting. Because of all that.
Raymond money?
Yeah. Yeah. There's some,
Raymond that, money's that's probably good. I don't know if it beats Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars money.
If
only that 6-year-old knew how rich he was going to be.
Oh my God. He would be such a dick. Back on set. Oh, that'd be amazing.
If Peter Boyle had just recorded Locked Out of Heaven, then like, maybe.
Oh, I'm in. I'm so in. What if you find out that
type that into AI and see what you get?
What if Peter Boyle has like songwriting credits on some of Bruno Mars's tracks? Like, we just never knew. They became best friends. They met at the premiere because they weren't in scenes together.
I just think the Hawaii stuff just doesn't work for a bunch of reasons. First of all, we're stuck in this fucking, you know, relationship, quote unquote, with Tommy and Betsy, where he's, I mean, she's on like a gondola or something, yeah, and or some sort of boat, and he sort of confesses to not rigging the game necessarily, but sort of confesses to enough, yeah, of it so that she feels, I guess, maybe more at ease. And then he kisses her, of course. It's gross. And I don't like it. And her, she seems very uncomfortable with it, as she should be. But then we also meet Pat Morita, shows up as Mahi Mahi, the cab, yeah, driver, who, I don't know. I mean, he's, I like Pat Morita, but I'm just like, the role just sort of seems, there's this idea, I think, from 30,000 feet, where he thinks, and by he, I mean Bergman, has written this script thinking, now it's a chase movie. Now, if I can keep Nicolas Cage on the run towards Betsy, then that'll help pull us through sort of the final half of this movie. But you don't really feel as though Nicolas Cage has any information to really go on. And he's also being thwarted at every turn by Mahi Mahi, that I'm just like, I don't know what I'm supposed to
do. And
you
never see like a conversation between Pat Morita, I refuse to call him by his character's name, you know, James Caan's overweight
the guy from Goodfellas
who can't stop eating. Yeah. Like you don't, I think that's a lot of what got like cut was, yes, the interstitial, yes, things that actually connected. I bet you in that poker scene, there are scenes showing how it was rigged, because there's no, yep, way any of that could have happened without them rigging it. And I think in editing, they were probably like, oh, no one's going to care. It's a fun ride and no one's going to want to, no one cares. So they just cut anything that held the logic.
I mean, this movie is 100 minutes and it's a pretty long 100 minutes. So I don't
it's 100 minutes too long. No, it's, yeah, about 90 minutes too long. I'd watch, yeah, 10 of it.
So at this point, essentially what happens is Tommy, James Caan, goes full on sociopath, and basically is like lying to Betsy, just totally gaslighting her on the amount of money that was transpired between him and Nicolas Cage, hoping to just straight up strong arm her into marrying him. I don't understand the idea. He's just like, just fucking marry me. Just sign the piece of paper. You're like, what are you getting out of this? I don't know why you want this so badly. She hates
Hunter
you.
And I, Hunter and I were talking about this. Like, it's as if he lives in a world where you can't get an annulment. He lives in a world, yes, where... Exactly. Betsy will never talk to Nicolas Cage ever again in her life. He can stop them from communicating. Like, it is so insane, yeah, that the need, weird, is...
But she agrees and immediately says, Tommy says, so what do you think? And she says, I'm going to want children very soon.
Yes! Oh!
I hate this movie. Like, I just, that was the moment where I was like, Betsy, are you bipolar? Like, what are we doing here? Right. You know this man's abusive. You know that you're not attractive.
It's not Betsy's fault. It's Bergman's fault. So be mad at Bergman.
Of course. I you know what I mean. But yeah, it's, I know. The idea that, like, I understand that she wants to get married, but how badly do you want to get married? How badly do you want children that you're going to have children with? And then there's that creepy moment when she meets his son and she holds his, yeah, infant, and he's like, wow, the kid's really taken to you. No one's like that with you. I'm just like, I stop it. Stop gaslighting this woman. God, I just, it,
but I think, like, and like, I don't want to carry any water for anyone, sure, in this movie, sure, or anything, but
yeah,
I just, and I don't feel bad for James Caan, but his character, like...
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else?
Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
In a world where this woman looks exactly like his ex-wife who died of skin cancer. Okay, fine. That's true. That is true. They're spitting it.
There's no truer fact.
That's a true fact. What does he have to gain by marrying her? And be like, he gets to be with someone who physically looks like his ex-wife, but is really not like her at all. And I get it. If he just said, I want to have sex with you, and it would be like having sex with my ex-wife or my dead wife, I would be like, I get that. That makes sense. But to be like,
isn't that the subtext of this movie, Hunter?
But why is it subtext? Like, it's like crazy. It's the only, I'm telling you, it's the only relatable thing in the movie.
I don't disagree with you.
It's just bizarre.
I know, but Phil, when you say it's a subtext, then it means essentially if I marry you, marry me, you are my property, and now I can legally
We're talking
have sex
about,
with you
yes,
whenever
yes.
I want, which is rape.
It's like marriage is the stand-in in the storytelling for sex.
Yeah,
but that just makes it more problematic.
And
it doesn't
as we all
make
know,
it easier.
That's not true.
Bergman,
right?
Bergman
marriage
said,
doesn't equal sex.
Yes, yeah, yes.
A lot of
marriage is the opposite of sex.
Sorry. A lot of the reviews like compared this to a screwball comedy, and it sounds like Bergman thought he was making a screwball comedy. But in screwball comedies, like the woman has a strong point of view and like has a way. And like the problem here is that like the romantic leads are Nicolas Cage and James Caan. Like they are the two who have like perspectives and have like clashing viewpoints. They're the ones who should be wanting to fuck. And then the movie works. But like,
I agree. And I also, you kind of just said it. And I feel like it hadn't really been said yet, which is like James Caan and Nicolas Cage being your romantic leads. Bizarre, like just bizarre in and of itself, right? Like I love Nicolas Cage and obviously he was in some comedies previous to this, and I understand that like you watch Moonstruck and you're like, yeah, this is the guy, he should be that guy, right? But
I think Nick Cage is a great rom-com lead. I think he's
I'm not saying he isn't, but playing him the James Caan the moment when like your movie, the two male leads in your movie are these two people, like you have to write that movie, and that's not the movie that's been written.
Right.
I'm trying to think of, I think part of it is that Sarah Jessica Parker is not the right, you want to have someone who matches their daffiness for this movie to have a prayer of working, and it's just not her.
Yeah. But and also like, again, you know, there's been many, many pieces written about sort of the idea that like male leads now are all like just the Chris's essentially. Like you don't get to really have faces anymore. You don't get to have like real kind of personalities. It feels like everyone's just sort of hot. You know, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Bodies, hot bodies. I don't see a problem with that. Go on.
But I do think that, like, this was a time when, like, you know, you could have these two guys as your male leads and it didn't feel weird. The weird part, to your point, Emily, is that the Sarah Jessica Parker component, she's just, like, she doesn't belong with either of them. It just doesn't make sense. And anyway, so at this point, basically, Betsy finally realizes that Tommy's psychotic. He's grabbing her arm. He's basically demanding that she be at his side the entire time. It's all getting. She knows that she's with a crazy person.
We're like rape adjacent right now.
We're very, very close to rape at this point. So she does what anyone would do, which is she gets into a showgirl outfit in order to
escape
him.
Again, Phil, you've never been married. So
I haven't been married. I don't know. That might be a thing. And then we have this sort of this, you know, this flying Elvis set piece, which, you know, in and of itself is
fun. Like, I don't have a problem with it. It's a good like 10 minutes of screen time. Like, it's a substantive amount of screen time that they dedicate.
Suits light up. That's fun.
It's fun.
Another thing. This is why also when I got to that moment, I was like, okay, if this is the climax, brilliant. Yes. Go back and show that Nicolas Cage is afraid of heights. That yes. Nicolas Cage,
yes.
you know, is just very, just, it's not a hard thing yes. to put in and just, you yes. know, pepper throughout so that yes. when this moment comes, that's why, because that moment she's like, you jumped out of a plane for me. It's like, yeah, see how she knew that yeah. he had this fucking fear, or maybe he doesn't even want to get, yeah. the only reason that's, he doesn't want to go to Vegas is he's scared of getting on an airplane, whatever the fuck it is.
No, like, well, and that's also,
not hard to do.
It's not, he loves Elvis like Nicolas Cage and yeah. whatever it is. Like, there's just ways to get him on that plane that feel more, you know, that pays off.
What if his mom said, promise me two things. Don't get married and never go skydiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Done. I have one last question before we rate this film, which is what's up with the naked mom jokes? Like what is like it doesn't
there's
work.
Phil, Andrew Bergman loves the Oedipus complex. He just honestly kind of he thinks that's funny. So I don't know.
It's just
a personal blind spot. I miss the naked callback. Mom jokes. Naked?
Are
mom
you kidding?
Jokes?
There's a it's naked like, mom joke kidding. At the beginning where they're walking on the screen.
Oh,
and she's talking about
his dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. I remember. Yeah.
Okay. And then the end, he's like, but she was naked. Yeah. Credits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of screenwriter who took a class on Freud and was like, there's some jokes in here. And yeah.
So as I mentioned, go ahead.
I did extracurricular work for this episode.
Oh shit.
So
Just let me know. I know you had a hard out, so I didn't want to.
That's fine. I'm going to do that and I'm going to rate it and then I'm going to go. And y'all can keep chatting.
Great.
This movie in 2014 had a Broadway musical made of it. For some reason, it ran.
Stacey and Hunter's, everyone was just shocked.
Andrew Bergman wrote the book. The score was by Jason Robert Brown, who's like one of the great modern composers who has never had a hit. He's made shows that are wildly critically acclaimed. Parade, which is currently in revival on Broadway where I am. The last 5 years, probably the most influential, one of the most influential musicals of the last 25 years. Bridges of Madison County is another great one that nobody saw. They never last very long. They always are like just a few months open, but he continues to get work because his critical reputation is so strong.
Was this a hit?
No, not at all. It was a huge flop. It was like, it got the worst reviews of his career. The critics were all kind of like, the story makes no sense. Got no Tony nominations, which is rare for a Jason Robert Brown joint. And I listened to the score. Do you know who plays the James Caan role? I will give you like five guesses. You would never get
five
it.
Five guesses. I mean,
it has to be Scott Caan. I mean, what are we doing?
No,
Willem Dafoe.
Nope. It's Tony Danza. It's Tony Danza he's kind of an okay singer. I listened to the score. It is not Jason Robert Brown's finest work, but he's trying to do a thing where the music is in the vibe of 60s, 70s Vegas. So you kind of like get the feel of a throwback, even though the plot's not explicitly a throwback. There's a song called Out of the Sun that Tony Danza sings about his dead wife's skin cancer. I'm not kidding.
That is fucking hilarious. That's hilarious.
You can see where they thought the Broadway musical was a better form for this. And I can also see that. And honestly, they make some tweaks to the story that kind of help. Like the mom keeps coming back in a way that like reveals this is a kind of a recurring manifestation for him.
Great.
Betsy has a little bit more agency, though not too much, because they kind of stick to the plot. It is a weird.
How do they do the skydiving? Is what I want to know. What it looked like.
I don't know,
stage.
Like, because obviously I can't watch it. You know, it closed quickly and it will never be revived. But I assume, like, they did. You know, they had rigging various.
Yeah, it's like a dance choreographed dance number.
But
oh my god, that's incredible!
It is. it is worth a listen on Spotify, not because it's good, but because you're like, okay, I guess like one of our finest modern composers was like, this is going to be the one. And it was not at all. It was by far the biggest flop of his career. So,
I mean, it's appropriately, I mean, this movie was not a success. There was no one was, I'm not sure that many people know it exists. So the idea that you would make a musical out of it just seems crazy to me.
I mean, it is definitely the thing that Broadway has where they like think any IP, it's the same thing as the film industry. They think any IP can become a musical, but like,
sure.
On the other hand, the premise of Honeymoon in Vegas is musical-ish. You could make it like work in that form. And Bergman apparently was like, he wanted to do some musical numbers and then that was not allowed, or it was too expensive or something. Okay. Also, I don't know why you would do musical numbers with James Caan, Jess, and Nicolas Cage. But
I mean, I'll tell you,
SJP can sing.
Yeah, she can.
But I also feel like
should have been the one character that sang. Like that would have worked if she just like suddenly was doing like musical soliloquy.
Yeah, get her in the costume as she's hiding, and then she gets pulled up. Come on, it's time. And at the end, she gets pulled up and she sings, and then that way she could be like, "You jumped out of a plane. You sang in public." Like that was her biggest fear.
I totally agree with all of that, and I also think that if this movie had gone bigger, if it had musical set pieces, if it was just even wackier, I might not have the same problems with it. It's like it's weirdly grounded.
Yeah.
Also, if it makes no fucking sense.
Andrew Bergman's thing is it's wacky, but it's grounded. And when it works, it works. And when it doesn't, it really doesn't.
Yeah. So, Emily, what's your rating?
I saw that when I saw this in 93, 94, I thought I liked it. I kind of liked all movies back then, but it probably would have been like 65. I probably been pretty close to the Rotten Tomatoes score. Now, there were elements of it I liked. I don't think this movie works as a whole, but I'm going to go 42. Like there's stuff in it I think is fun, but it's kind of a mess.
Hunter.
Oh my God. I don't think I saw this movie. I mean, I definitely, the Flying Elvises is just sort of like I think just from trailers was like a very zeitgeisty
and
thing.
And the poster, I think too. Maybe.
Yeah, that was like very zeitgeisty. So I was definitely aware of it. There's a chance I tried to watch it on HBO or USA like back in the day and just didn't get into it. It's pretty bad. I mean, I just didn't enjoy it like at all. I feel sort of bad about it. I'm gonna give it a 20.
Okay.
I'm just gonna give it a 20. I'm shot. Roger Ebert giving it a 3.5 stars is completely
Can I ask
wild.
You a question though, Hunter?
Yeah,
did you like this more or less than Brain Donors?
I mean, in some ways, and you're going to pull up my scores and I'm going to be lying, but I don't know what my scores are. I don't keep track.
I don't remember it.
But I think in some ways I appreciate Brain Donors a little bit more because I think they quote unquote went for it. Whereas
and they're trying to do a thing.
Like what Emily's saying about it's wacky, but it's grounded. I'm like, well, who gives a fuck? Like it's neither one of them. It's like it's totally inconsistent is what it is. And I think Brain Donors at least sticks to a tone, for better or worse.
I forgot the queerphobia scale. I'm going to give it four. I'm going to give it a 4 because, again, like not a lot of overt queerphobia, but there are like jokes that sort of skirt around the edges of it. And also, Nicolas Cage is so clearly afraid of being seen for his love for James Caan deep down.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to go. Y'all keep talking. Okay. Thank you so much.
We'll see you soon. Bye. So I agree with you, Hunter, on the Brain Donors thing, which I think I enjoyed more than this. If for no other reason that it gave zero fucks, right? Like it was just like, we're burning this place down and enjoy. Whereas this movie feels like it's actually like thinks it's good.
I mean, like the Brain Donors thing is a little bit, it's one of those movies that, I mean, I was making fun of like the Mad Men, you have to go read the article thing. But if you watch Brain Donors without knowing that it's like, kind of a remake of a combination of Marx Brothers movies, you kind of go, oh, you kind of have a little bit more of an appreciation for it. It doesn't necessarily make it better, but you at least go, I can see what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, so Stacey, You yes. saw this back in the day, or you'd not? You,
no, maybe, no idea.
Yeah, you don't really remember. So
I'm not going to give it a. I'm not.
Yeah. What is your rating? What's your rating now?
I'm going to give it. I'm going to give it a 30. For the Nicolas Cagey moments that I enjoyed. Sure. I was just thinking about the moment where he's trying to get a ticket at the airport, mm-hmm. and what's his face? Stein.
Ben Stein.
Yeah. You know, love to see a little Ben Stein is, of course,
he's never done anything anymore. Wrong. He's never done anything wrong. He's not a wonderful person.
Not anymore. She's being very oblivious to everything. Yeah. That's fine.
He's really not a good person, by the way.
Well, what'd he do?
He's like crazy right wing.
He's the worst.
It's a crazy right wing.
Oh.
But anyway.
Okay, forget.
Live in bliss.
He was funny part. In this. He's,
cut,
I mean, like.
Cut anything I said about Ben Stein, no, but I mean, for that, I'll give it a 30. And also, you know, to see an SJP who's brave enough to show her bare back.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give I'd some that, you know, that's why I'll give it a 30. You know, I think I learned more from a bad movie than a good one. So this taught me a few things about how to not fuck up a script in the future. So that's a 30.
For me personally, I had like a weird amount of sort of nostalgia is the wrong word, but you know, an affinity for it just based on what I said earlier. I saw it with my mom when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
So I probably didn't like it as a kid particularly, but I liked that she liked it, so whatever. So I'm not going to rate it, but
100.
I came into this podcast. I was in the high 40s. I was like at a 49 ish. I'm down to like a 39, 40. I think we're all kind of in the same boat. I do think I think the frustrating part with a movie like this is that you see potential in it, right? Like we were all like looking for fixes and seeing what could have been. And there's something interesting that could have been in this. I think Nicolas Cage is fine in this movie. The Ben Stein thing I think is funny. Because I'm curious as to what you guys think of this on the comedy side of things, which is you don't see it as much when like a comedian found a bit or a thing.
Yeah.
And that's all they ever did.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it was just if it was Stephen Wright, if it was Gilbert Gottfried,
yeah,
Ben, right. Or Ben Stein.
It's very 80s, 90s. Like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, people just stop doing that.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it would be like Sam Kinison. You're like, wait, you're like, he's gonna do the thing.
What's the next gear?
He's gonna do it. Yeah.
It's so funny to me that I feel like I imagine it's probably just honestly a money thing, right? Which is if you have more gears, you have more opportunities to make money. But like back then, I guess stand up and that stuff would, you know, worked. I don't know how that even happened.
No, I think and there is a like you're saying having different gears and there's people. You know, once Jim Carrey did The Man on the Moon, that was the Andy Kaufman, right? It's like, he can do a different. Like, I just saw that they are, it looks like Will Ferrell's going to do the John Madden movie.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of like, I sort of hate it because I don't think John Madden's
making it.
Well, first of all, it seems insane. But also, like, John Madden, I don't think was ever intentionally funny. Like he's just who he was and kind of said insane shit. And you know, that's not who Will Ferrell is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just we live in an interesting time where.
Well, I think Will Ferrell's an interesting person to point out too, because I feel like he had a thing, right?
Yes.
And then like all of these comedians, it feels like I think Robin Williams was probably the first guy to really sort of, you know, does Dead Poets Society, tries to kind of break out and becomes a successful dramatic actor on top of being Robin Williams as a comedic actor. And then obviously your Tom Hanks's and your Jim Carrey's to, you know, varying degrees of success. And Will Ferrell's trying to follow in that path for a while. He does Stranger Than Fiction and he does like some smaller indie films to show like he does a Woody Allen movie. Like he tries to show he can do different things and just no one wants it. Like right, I ultimately just feels like no one. Yeah.
Do Step Brothers too, please.
That's it. Just do. I mean, and I feel like when he is Like, I feel like when he does a small part in a show or he does, you know, a cameo, he does Will Ferrell. You know what I mean? Yep, like, that's why you're hiring him to do the thing he does. So,
well, it's interesting, too, because, like, well, first of all, every time I watch the credits for Succession and his name comes up, I'm like, so weird. But it's then, like, it's just like, what's happening? But then also it feels like, I mean, I'm sure you guys read about the whole dust up between him and Adam McKay for Winning Time and him wanting to be the Jerry Buss character. And I understand why he's, first of all, I'm sure he was hurt just because his friend didn't want him in the show, but also because that might have been something he could have nailed and might have actually had been a weird bridge to show people that he has other tools in his belt. So I think that's part of it too, but like, he could have been good in that. But anyway,
well, did you watch Succession? Just, sorry, but I did.
I very much enjoyed it. I thought it was amazing.
I found this season to be so exhausting that I was like, please be over.
I mean,
I'm like,
intentionally exhausting though, but I hear what you're saying.
But like, because there's 10 episodes, it's like, let's stretch kind of a lot of the same beats as far as character wise throughout, you know, but whatever.
I'll just say this one quick thing, because I do think it's worth, it's not really obviously about what we're talking about, but I had a few friends over and we watched it last night, and one of the things that HBO does pretty consistently and that I love is when they take their central character off the board. So if it's Tony Soprano getting injured and being in this purgatorial state, if it's Nate Fisher dying, if it's Swearengen, they'll take that central character and remove it to show how chaotic the world is without this person in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they kill Logan as early in the season as they did, I appreciate that, like, that meant we were going to watch seven episodes of flailing, seven episodes of these kids without their North Star. And to your point, Hunter, and I don't disagree, like, that was hard to watch for seven episodes, but I also feel like that was Jesse rubbing our face in how dysfunctional they are without him.
Right. I also think I appreciated the seven episodes to tell us the Shiv and Tom story, especially where that ended. So
It was, I'll just say this, you know, as I'm sure you guys do, we're all TV writers, and ending a show seems impossible to me personally. Like, I'm just like, if you can stick the landing in any way, shape, or form, if the passengers survive the flight,
Of course,
congratulations. It's so rare that that happens. And I was really worried about this show because I love this show. And when you're invested, not just as a viewer, but as a creative.
You didn't want them to pull a Game of Thrones, you know?
Yeah, you didn't. You were just like, please let it be good. And it was an hour and a half on top of everything. And I was like, I don't know if that's a good thing. Like, I don't know if 90 minutes is what this needs. And it was great. Like, I didn't feel its length. In fact, you know, there's a point in the story, probably my guess is around the 40-minute part, where you're just like, they're all too happy.
No, that was great. That's one of the things when you look at the time, like you're saying, and you go, well, wait, how much time's left? Because this all has to fall apart.
It was great. And you know, this is tenuous, but to connect back to Honeymoon in Vegas, I'll just say this, great writing. When you see great writing and you're just like, everyone else is a chump. And if anything, you watch this show and you're just like, I mean, I'll never even be remotely close to as good as these writers are and what they've accomplished. And when it all just feels like a Swiss watch and you read all the fucking Easter egg stuff online and you see all the things that Jesse Armstrong and these writers were threading into this show over the four seasons that it existed, you're just like, yeah, that's the way it should be.
Well, the thing that I read is that Wamsgans is the name of the
baseball player
who had an unassisted triple play. Which
is perfect.
Now it's taken out all three kids.
And also there's the poem that all the titles of the finales have been taken from. I'll send you the link. And forgive me, I don't know the poem off the top of my head either, but the poem is essentially Kendall's arc. Like, you can just see how it breaks down, all the various things that are going. So it's like, it's you know, I love that shit. It just goes to show that like people take the time and they put in the effort and it's rewarding for us.
And they should be paid.
And fucking they should be paid. Yes.
Bring it back
also,
to the strike.
If people have not read the numerous articles about your love story, they should be.
Oh my God. It's out of control.
It is fantastic. You guys are super famous for your love, as you should be.
Who would have ever thought?
Who would have ever thought that would be? But no, I mean, you guys are the best, and I'm so thrilled when you come on individually and together. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this dog shit movie.
I'm excited to do a good movie with you someday, Phil.
You're gonna do a good movie. I mean, here's the thing: 92 is a weird year. As I'm sure list.
It's very strange.
But I will say that as our listeners know, sometime soon the pool is going to expand in terms of the amount of movies. So it'll be a lot easier for you to come on for something that you actually enjoy, Hunter. And obviously, Stacey, you've got some stuff in the hopper with us for 92.
The real question is, do I enjoy any movie? That's turning into
a question. That's a separate podcast.
That's probably a separate. I mean, you liked The Hangover. You came on.
That's true.
You guys did not like The Thomas Crown Affair. You guys did not like Bowfinger.
I end up liking it more. The Bowfinger
still baffles me. I'm still, and some of the, like, don't get me wrong, the Heather Graham stuff is bad and it's no good and don't do it. But there's a lot of funny shit in Bowfinger.
This movie, Honeymoon in Vegas, makes Bowfinger look like Citizen Kane. I mean,
to be fair, she said that during the movie last night. She literally was like, holy shit.
But it's interesting because this does connect as we wrap this up. But I was just say, like, you look at the SJP character in this, you look at the Heather Graham character in Bowfinger, and then you compare it to the Rene Russo character in Thomas Crown Affair, which I'm not saying is a great, great movie. But I do think Rene Russo's got agency.
She at least
is fucking in control of her narrative. You know, whether or not she's, you know, in love with this guy and doing things for the wrong reasons is whatever. That's a human fallacy.
That's how that happened. You know. Yeah.
But I'll just say, like, it just makes, I would argue, Heather Graham and Rene Russo's characters make Sarah Jessica Parker's character look even worse.
Yeah, for sure.
It's bad. But yes. You guys are the best. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. I can't wait
to come back on. And I can't wait to see you guys in the picket lines. Where are you picketing? Which studio?
Mostly Radford.
Radford. But then I've heard Disney. The circle is really tight at Radford and I hate it.
It's just, you feel like you're just going like,
and it's in the Radford. Like the most direct sun in blazing Southern sun. California. Disney is really beautiful, so I think I might hit that up this
Disney
week.
Disney is a big, like, you can do a big loop, so you don't feel as though you're just kind of going.
I'm a big guy, and if I feel like I'm just shuffling my feet around, I can't. It's very difficult.
I hear that. My problem is, you're over the hill, I'm not over the hill.
Yeah, no, of course.
So it's like this, it's like I have lots of friends over the hill, and I'm just like, I just don't want to. And Universal sucks. It's weird. It's a weird walking space. Fox is so close to me, but I'm just not much. Yeah, so it's just, it's weird.
What about,
it's
like, Paramount?
I went to Paramount the other day, which was fine. I mean, it's again,
what,
it's
have
not
you done
a
Netflix.
Huge... Netflix is the most fun, but
it
there's
seems
nowhere
like
to fucking
party.
Park.
Yeah.
So you're like, it is. It's definitely the party, and it definitely feels as though it's the one that everyone's decided is the villain. So, like, everyone's just like, right. "Fuck Netflix."
They're the creators of computer TV. That's really
correct.
Fucked all
correct.
Of us.
So, like, really. You don't, you know, which is surprising, since like I haven't heard people going to Amazon because it's Culver City, and people are just like, "I'm not driving all the fucking way to Culver City."
Or Sony, really?
Or either. Sony. Yeah. So you've got both those places. I don't think are getting picketed much.
You got better weather. I think as it gets hotter, people will move to those places.
I mean, you're not going to want to be in Netflix in August. I mean, that's going to be a nightmare. Oof.
Hopefully, we're not going to be anywhere in August, Hunter. But I understand your point.
I think I'm figuring where I'm picketing in December.
Stop
just
it.
To get it.
Here's the thing.
No,
that
they're
I've
not
realized.
Even negotiating. Well, I talked to Betsy Thomas and she was like,
you know why they're not negotiating right now, but that's neither here nor there. They're not negotiating because they're negotiating with two other guilds. But I do think that my hope is that this does resolve itself relatively quickly. But I'll say this too.
Don't ever look to writers for optimism. On these fucking picket lines, everyone's just like so fucking down. I'm like, guys, you have to have cautious optimism. Otherwise, like, what are we doing?
It's so crazy. It's so true. Yeah. When you're on the picket line, everyone's like, whoa, 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 which I get it. It sucks. But on Instagram, everyone's posting like it's a party. And then they have to post saying, by the way, this isn't a party. Like, no one wants to be on strike.
I think, not to turn this into a strike podcast, I'll just say this.
Too late.
I'll just say this. I think that posting pictures of yourself having a good time on the picket lines, A, is not a bad thing, because I think that it's basically showing the people that we're striking against that this is that. We're having a good time and we're not fucking going anywhere. Yep. And we're going to keep doing this.
Right.
So I think there's that.
Totally agree.
And I also just think that, you know, Instagram, and I know you guys aren't on Twitter anymore for your own mental health, which I think is great for both of you. But I'll just say that that Twitter has been very helpful. You guys obviously were striking in 07 and you know how hard it was to get people to places at specific times.
No, that's the good part about social media.
That's the good point, which is that, you know, being able to say, be at this gate at this time to shut down this show.
Mobile, all that stuff is working really well. I think that's good. Yeah, and I think, you know, just speaking to, do I want a bunch of articles written about me? Not really. I find it very strange. And I actually, I'm at the maximum level for the year of articles written about me. But I do think that from a PR standpoint, is getting any story out about the strike and getting anybody eyes on anything, whether it's something as dumb as our love, which doesn't really matter. And, you know,
your love's not dumb. Your love is beautiful.
But it's like frivolous in terms of what we're fighting against and everything. I know that a lot of people don't give a shit, but I think the point is to get the message out that we are on strike. And I think trying to find reasons to go picket every day becomes harder and harder, and maybe finding love can be one of them.
I'll say this too, that, you know, I remember the trades and deadline back in 07. And I'm not sitting here saying that they aren't still biased and they aren't still owned by these studios, because they very much are. But I will say too that I've been surprised to some degree as to how it has been covered by the media. I think part of it is because the studios, like, everyone is for the writers. Like, it's clear as day that no one is for the studios. So from a clickbaity perspective and from getting people to write these articles and read these articles, the only way to do it is to humanize us, because there's no fucking way you're going to humanize them.
Yep.
So it is interesting to see how the media has been sort of covering it. They've been covering it in slightly.
I also way. I feel like, if you know, in 2007-08, Zaslav, if you were there, is not getting booed at BU. They wouldn't. BU wouldn't know. The students wouldn't know about our fight. And now the fact that our struggle is known, and like we got interviewed by this writer for an Italian newspaper, and she was like, they care about the strike. It's also the content, I hate to use content, but the stuff that we write and produce is seen everywhere in a way that maybe it wasn't back then, because there wasn't computer TV. So
there's also I mean people keep saying that 2007 strike was the rise of reality television, which I don't think it really was, but that's been conflated into that. And then there's a lot of stories about, whether it's Heroes or whatever, things getting interrupted. So I think there's a whole mythology and narrative now that the strike is going to really fuck up people's entertainment. And in 2007, it was like, they're on strike, they'll figure it out and get, but it did have some ripples. And I think people now are like, Even like the Deadpool thing, and it being like, well, Ryan Reynolds can't improv because that's writing. And, you know, you can't do ADR because that's writing too. And it's like, do people want to see a Deadpool movie where Ryan Reynolds is handed a script and you just do the script? And it's like, no. So I think even things like that, people are much, much more aware of like, oh, this is actually going to fuck shit up. And
I totally agree. I also think too that, like, on top of everything else, you know, not to get political, but I do think that, you know, unions and that idea is something that is very much in the zeitgeist right now. You're seeing a lot more pro-union sentiment, part of it to push obviously back against the right. But still, I think that union busting and companies trying to fuck over unions, again, looks fucking terrible and everybody hates it globally. Yeah. And I think that it is, it's just, it's all kind of coming to a head, which is why there's a part of me that's like, you know, we are seeing SAG be more vocal and more ballsy than they've
ever been
in over for almost 40 years.
Yep.
You're seeing the DGA being more vocal and they're complete pussies. So yeah. Like this idea that there's a, even a chance, whether or not it's high or not, that all three of these guilds could be on strike come 4th of July is a shocking thing to even consider.
Yep.
So I, this is all just to say that like, it's all crazy, but I think that some good can come from all of this. And I hope that some good comes from all of this. And it's the only way I can think about it. Otherwise I won't get out of bed in the morning. So I totally understand.
No, but it is, that, you know, it is a problem. And again, I think this is why it's relatable. It's a problem with the entire country that there is no trickle down and we're losing a middle class, and we have been. And that's what the bigger fight that we're fighting for is like, why do these corporations have so much money? And these guys at the top, what did they do to earn that kind of money? It's fucking, it's insane.
It is interesting. I read a quote that I retweeted this morning, and I'm paraphrasing it, but I do think it taps into what you're saying, Stacey, which is that the companies don't look at us as a source of content. They look at us as a cost of content. Oof. And I think that is a big thing, right? Like they look at us as a number on a budget, as opposed to we're actually creating
with the source of something.
And I think it's the same with actors. It's the same with directors. It's the same with any creative entity. It's a number on a line budget, as opposed to looking at all of these things as a collective and what they're obviously bringing you on the other side of it. So, you know, it's hopefully our strike and potentially other strikes will make that even more apparent. It's also like, this is obviously an unbelievably lucrative business. The entertainment business is so unbelievably lucrative, and it's the most lucrative to that, you know, that top tier, that rarefied air of people that exist up there, which is why I'm hoping that all these articles written about you guys, written about other writers, humanizes this situation so that people who watch all this stuff that just think we're all rolling around in piles of cash and that we're all living the high life, that they understand that A, we're not, and B, this is why, and that all these things you love come from us. They don't come from fucking David Zaslav. So like, it's incredibly important.
I think that, you know, where I am in my career, and I'm 45 years old and I'm basically out of the business, not making any money. I haven't been in a writer's room since 2019. I haven't sold anything. I haven't sold a pilot since December of 2021. I have, not only do I have really good credits, I have credits that have made corporations shit tons of money. Mm-hmm. So whatever you want to say about my contributions to these shows, I don't really give a shit. My point is I've made these people tons of money and I'm basically out of the business. Yep. So if you're a 25-year-old writer, you might want to think about that and think about, there's a lot of shows today that are quote unquote good credits that have made $0 for their corporations.
The idea of how money is made today and how we are fucked out of it and how any number of people are fucked out of it is the streaming created chaos, and it's the chaos that they thought they wanted, and unfortunately or fortunately it has not become that. I think that they went it, you know, way too hard, way too fast on a distribution method that they didn't fully understand the repercussions of, and they're learning that the hard way right now. So I mean, we'll see how it all shakes out, but this was obviously our episode on Honeymoon in Vegas.
Yes, clearly.
So but again, you guys are the best. I'm sure I'll see you soon on the picket line.
Can I ask one question? Absolutely. That I didn't bring up and I should have brought it up at the very beginning of the podcast. Yeah. Do we think that the movie was written with a voiceover? or do we feel like that was added, right?
No.
Yeah, I mean, that's the number one sign that a movie is going to be a piece of shit, when all of a sudden a voiceover comes in and you're like, wait a second.
Fill you in on information and then drop out of the movie.
And then it goes away.
It's just one of the worst things ever to see.
What I was wondering, and it taps into this movie and obviously taps into what we were talking about, which is this movie is only available for purchase. You cannot stream this film anywhere. We found a way, but that's neither here nor there.
I want you to tell people that it's also not only is it only available for purchase, it's only in standard definition.
Correct. For $15.
And there was Stacey, what was the Anne Bancroft thing? She says fuck, but it was
We actually bought it, Phil, and I don't want to get into that, but you were worth it. I appreciate you guys.
There was a moment of the not wanting to figure out how to download and
totally get it.
And we just want to watch on the TV and whatever. But she says, she says screw you. The voice, you see her mouth say fuck. It's like they edited it for the version I'm buying. It was wild.
Well, actually, the answer to your question is this film almost got an R rating.
Got it.
So it was pulled for PG.
Yeah.
But the fucked up part of it is, you know, why'd you stay on her mouth? Like, just cut behind her and just dub it in that way. Because I've seen, you guys have too, many movies where the person's clearly saying fuck. Like, they're and it is what it is. But this is a close-up of her face. Like, this is not like a wide or a medium shot, so it's insane.
It's lazy.
This whole movie is
lazy, but
the reason I was curious, and I don't know the answer to this obviously, but this happens from time to time when you do a podcast on movies, you're constantly trying to figure out where to watch those things. And sometimes you get into a situation where it's only available for purchase rather than rent anywhere. And it starts streaming, and I'm just like, what are these metrics? How does this stuff like shake out, and why do certain? So I don't know how that, but it's all just sort of part of this money making.
No, but this is the question too, right? Because Stacey did a show called Notes from the Underbelly, which is a Warner Brothers show. Yeah. Why is that not on HBO Max? I'm so fucking sorry. Why is that not on Max? Like, it doesn't. It's like you have it.
I don't know.
Like, it's just
We did 23 episodes. I think a total of only maybe 10 aired over the two seasons we did it. And it was the last year strike, but you have free content that's been made that we spent money on. And I, even back then, you know, when I remember, cause I worked on Kitchen Confidential and they did put out like a DVD box set of all the episodes. Mm-hmm. And again, it's because Bradley Cooper's in it, and I don't have that kind of actor in mind. But it also seems like it's Warner Brothers. You own it. It's free.
But there's somebody in your show that Bradley Cooper had sex with, so it feels people want to watch that. No, but it's just interesting. And I'm not saying what's a great show and not a great show and anything like that. It just feels weird. And we've all seen them put stuff on that then just pops and does. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I feel like Kitchen Confidential just got put back up.
I'm sure it's on Hulu.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I do think that, I mean, this is a grander question in terms of sort of the bigger picture of the choices that are being made, what shows are being pulled off of these streaming networks and why.
Yes.
Part of it, I imagine, is the amount of money they have to pay out to the people that create these shows, act in these shows, what have you. And someone crunches the numbers and says, vinyl is worthless to us if I have to pay Martin Scorsese.
Yes.
So I'm pulling this off of HBO Max.
I agree with that. And the part of the thing is, which no creative person wants to face, and even more fans don't want to face, who's watching vinyl? I mean, like, literally, there are shows, believe me, there could be shows that I wrote on that could be the same way. There are shows that I'm sure get under 100 views a year, and then it's just like it doesn't make any sense. I mean, we were in that WGA Zoom, and there was a guy talking about how much money he made on DVD sales, and he was like, how can we make the studios start putting stuff back out on DVD First of all,
which is hilarious when we were screwed on DVD.
I mean, yeah, by the way, that was the worst deal that we had in the history of the guild. But it's just like,
yeah, it's nuts.
It's not happening. I mean, so I understand the business side of it, I guess.
No, of course. And I don't mean to suggest that the bigger question ultimately is, you know, whether or not these streamers are interested in being completists and interested in being a place where someone knows that all of their content can be found and what that's worth to them versus the idea of pulling stuff off of there. I would also say too, that, you know, there's all sorts of great shows that you can't buy in any capacity.
Yeah.
You can't buy them in DVD. You can't buy them on iTunes. They essentially don't exist anymore. Yeah. That's fucking crazy.
I guess, and the other thing is, which this leads me to, is just show us the fucking numbers. Tell us what's going on. Tell us how many people watched episode one of Stranger Things and how many people watched episode 8 or whatever the fuck the last season was.
Yep.
Like, we need, like, there's no transparency in that. And so it's like, if you can come and say...
We're not chasing that right now in the strike. I think is because ironically advertising is what's going to save us, which is that
I mean,
all of these advertisers are going to be put back into these things, which means they're going to start asking questions, which is, I'm not giving you X amount of dollars unless you tell me how many people watch the show.
Speaking of shows you can't see anymore, I was just listening to the latest season of You Must Remember This, Karina Longworth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was talking about Red Shoe Diaries, you know, the it's erotic 90s. And there, you can't get most of those episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, why not? You should totally be able.
Especially considering the fact that it costs them nothing to put it up on iTunes or to put it up on Amazon.
So, and David Duchovny's in them.
Like, you can buy. Like, it's not like you're saying let's mass produce DVDs again, which do come with a cost.
Sure.
This is literally just. You could put it out in standard definition. You don't even need to fucking remaster this thing.
Let
throw
people
it
buy
out
it.
On there, and people will buy it. Yeah. It's nuts. I don't understand it. Someone, I'm sure above me, can explain it to us, and someone can explain how they're saving fucking pennies by not doing it. But the whole thing's crazy. But I do think that ultimately, weirdly, advertisers are going to be the saving grace when it comes to the data transparency.
100%. I totally agree.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's crazy that we've gone this long without any sort of metric. We just continue to just listen to Netflix's bullshit numbers of like 8 billion hours were streamed over the course of like, it's just like, it's all.
They also moved the goalpost on
every time.
You have to watch less and less each time for it to count as a full view.
Yeah. There used to be a time where you had literally, if you rolled the cursor over the fucking icon, they'd start counting that as fucking minutes watched. And you're just like, guys, anyway.
Just minutes watched. Like, fuck you. Like, what kind of, like, no. Like, in the 90s, nobody was like, how many episodes of Friends do you, or how many minutes of Friends do you watch per week?
Right.
Like, what?
But I do remember, and I'm sure you guys remember this too, although you both primarily write in the half hour space, but when you would get the ratings for the hour longs, you would see the share
drop off.
Right. So you see people who actually stuck around to watch the entire fucking episode. And it's just like, we don't have anything like that anymore. Yeah. We're just going blindly by these numbers that they decide to give us. It's crazy. But anyway, love you guys. I'll see you on the picket line soon.
Yes.
And great. All right. Awesome.
Bye. Take care.
Peace.
Bye. Podcast Nuggets. 1992.